TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Yanis Varoufakis. Is capitalism devouring democracy? The two June 2018 programs by TUC Radio, with the economist and renegade former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, drew such a huge response that we are following up with an extraordinary excerpt from a May 9, 2018 talk at the Cambridge Forum. In that talk, Yanis Varoufakis makes the point that democracy and capitalism are incompatible. However, capitalism also can't maintain itself, he says. It is a self-devouring system. And with great urgency, he invites us today to resolve the question of who is going to survive, democracy or the global financial system. In this excerpt of his near two-hour talk, Varoufakis traces the origins of the current economic crisis from 1929 through the New Deal, through World War II, through Bretton Woods to 2008 and beyond. And all in 24 minutes. Varoufakis is weaving in illuminating historic facts, such as why bankers were not allowed to participate in the drafting of Bretton Woods, how the Marshall Plan saved the U.S. economy, how Bretton Woods collapsed in the 1970s, and why and how bankers became instrumental in rescuing the U.S. from collapse after the U.S. bankrupted itself by going on a global shopping spree, and why we need a new deal. Yanis Varoufakis was already an internationally known economist and academic when he was elected to the Greek parliament as a member of the Syriza party at the height of the Greek debt crisis. He served as Minister of Finance in 2015. He resigned in protest over the imposition of structural adjustment and bailout loans on the Greek people, loans that then were used to bail out the banks. Varoufakis said that this was a transfer of losses from private banks to Greece's and Europe's taxpayers. Here is Yanis Varoufakis.
Something fundamental happened beginning in this country in the 1970s. After the end of Bretton Woods, which was what? What was Bretton Woods? Let's not get complicated. It was the globalization of the New Deal. Roosevelt's New Deal in 1933, which was, what was the basic idea? To put the financial genie, the banking genie, back into its bottle, to make banking boring, effectively to ban bankers from doing things that allowed too much money to be created and too many bubbles to be built up, mobilizing idle savings, the idle savings of the richer members of society, and putting those idle savings, turning them into a force in the public interest, infrastructural works, public works, education, social security, and so on. That was the New Deal. In 1944, towards the end of the war, the New Dealers extended that New Deal internationally as Europe was just a pile of ashes. Japan, you don't need me to explain what happened to Japan in 1945. So Bretton Woods, it was a magnificent system. Think about it. The United States officialdom in D.C. effectively designed a global capitalist system that was like a planned economy. You have fixed exchange rates, 4% interest rates forever, 20 years of 4% interest rates, no ups and downs. It was maybe plus or minus 0.1%. So you knew what your mortgage rate would be in the next 20 years. You knew if you wanted to change dollars for British pounds, you knew how many pounds you would get. You would get the same quantity year in, year out. So it was a world which was a nightmare for financiers. And of course, that was by design. Did you know that in the Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire in 1944, Roosevelt imposed one single rule on his own? The rest he left to his minions. There were representatives from 100 different countries, most of them already they were not even liberated yet. They were under occupation because it was 1944. The Second World War had not ended. Experts, diplomats, politicians, and so on. One species of humanity was banned from entering the Washington Hotel. Bankers. A whole monetary global system was created on condition that bankers would not be part of it. Yeah? Interesting. You know, if anybody proposed this today, they would immediately be branded as raving communist lunatics. This was Bretton Woods, 1944. You know, it's important to think back about possibilities when we think of what is possible. But that system collapsed towards the end of the 1960s, officially 15th of August 1971, with Nixon's announcement that it's kaput, it's finished. I'm not going to go into this. But what happened after that was a very interesting, fascinating reversal in the flow of trade and money around the world. Before the collapse of Bretton Woods, what was happening was this. This is how Bretton Woods was designed. America was a surplus country, especially after the Second World War, was the only creditor country, the only country that had the surpluses, financial surpluses, surpluses of goods, a net exporter. And what the United States administration did as part of Bretton Woods was to say, okay, the only way of preventing a return of the Great Depression to this land, number one, we convert all our factories from military production to civilian production, producing white goods instead of tanks and bullets, producing cars instead of aircraft carriers. Right, but that's not enough, because those factories during the war economy were so productive in this country that they were capable of producing so many washing machines, tractors, and cars that Americans would simply not have enough use for them. The only way of preventing the Great Depression from returning was by selling them to the Europeans. But the Europeans didn't have money. So new dealers, being very practical people, said, well, we'll give them the money. It's what's called the Marshall Aid Plan. For 20 years, the United States was recycling about 70% of American profits in Japan and in Europe, because this is what you do if you're a clever hegemon. What you do is you make sure that the only way that you can continue to have surpluses vis-a-vis somebody else is to finance them. Because if you don't, then they won't be able to afford to buy your stuff. Then you won't be able to have surpluses. The problem was, however, that those surpluses disappeared by the late 60s. America shifted from a surplus position to a deficit position. Both the government went in deficit and the American economy developed a trade deficit. It is fascinating that what happened after the collapse of Bretton Woods had been imagined by some smart fellows in this country. Remember Henry Kissinger? Yeah. He's a smart cookie, right? And in 1970, a year before the end of Bretton Woods, he was not yet Secretary of State. He was still head of the National Security Council. And of course, you know, he's a cold warrior, geopolitical thinker. He thinks in terms of, you know, a bit like Metternich would have in the 19th century. So he asked all the people that were working for him the pertinent question. Now that the United States is shifting into a deficit position, how can we maintain our global hegemony? All empires, superpowers, fell once they became deficit countries or economic blocks. A young man wrote a memo, 3/4 of a page. It was the most brilliant reply, and the one that really explains what happened between the 1970s and 2008 in the world, and of course in the United States. His answer was, it doesn't really matter whose surpluses are being recycled. What really matters to maintain in control is to be the one who is recycling other people's surpluses. Get it? We can maintain our superpower status, our hegemony, as long as we do the recycling of surpluses, even if the surpluses are not ours. Think about it. This is exactly the model that we have been living through between the 1970s and 2008. America turned into a deficit country. And now Donald Trump is complaining, oh, you know, we have a huge trade deficit with China, with Germany, we need to eliminate it. Either he's completely unschooled, or he's lying, or both. globalization would not have happened without the American deficits. The American trade deficit operated like a gigantic vacuum cleaner that was sucking into this country the net exports of Germany, of Holland, of France, of Japan, and later, of course, of China, keeping those factories going at full blast. Eh? And this deficit kept increasing. It is this increasing American trade deficit that kept globalized capitalism in rude health. Now, of course, the question then is, how was it being paid for? Because Greece had a big deficit, and look at what happened to us. Well, this is the exorbitant privilege of the United States of America. At the very same time that the trade deficit was expanding, the rest of the world was sending to this country 70% of all profits the Germans made, the Dutch made, the Japanese made, and the Chinese are making. 70% of global profits were coming into Wall Street, seeking higher returns, being used to purchase US Treasury bills, you know, American government debt. And so you had a pure recycling loop. So recycling was discovered by this young man, whose name, by the way, is Paul Volcker, who then became the chairman of the Fed, and who, just a week before he assumed the position of chairman of the Fed, in a lecture he gave at the University of Warwick in England, he said, this is the time when a controlled disintegration of the world economy is in the interest of the United States of America, verbatim. I've learned this off by heart because it's so exciting. The controlled disintegration of the world economy, so that's what he meant. So you had this amazing system where you have increasing imbalances globally, America growing its deficits, Germany and Japan and then China growing its surpluses. When we increase our deficit, we are creating an imbalance. When somebody else is increasing their surplus, that's an imbalance. And globalization was based on this. Financialization. What's financialization? Why was Wall Street allowed to go crazy? Why were all the checks and balances that the new dealers introduced and Bretton Woods introduced, why did they go to the dogs? Why did Larry Summers, why was he allowed to commit the crime against logic and humanity, to unleash the Wall Street bankers from their shackles, the result being 2008? The answer is because without unleashing the Wall Street bankers, it was impossible to close that loop. The only way you could have this model of the world economy where the United States deficit was keeping the rest of globalization going, with the rest of the world sending its surpluses into Wall Street for Wall Street to close the loop and pay for the deficit, was to let the Wall Street bankers do as they pleased. And when you do let the Wall Street bankers do as they please, you know what they do? You give a banker a few billion every day, for 5 minutes. Just park 5 billion with a banker for 5 minutes every day. This is to invite them to create very sophisticated bets using that 5 billion every day that they are always going to win. The problem is that they built so many pyramids of financialized derivatives on top of this tsunami of capital that the rest of the world was saying that it combusted in 2008. And the result was what we're facing. The point I'm making is that all power ended up with finance. Because if you allow bankers to push their hand into the future so majestically, frequently, and without any kind of control, to bring value that has not been produced yet into the future and effectively to appropriate it themselves. And then you also say to them that they're too big to fail, and when they fail, you know, then austerity for all is combined with socialism for the bankers, then they have no reason why not to keep undermining capitalism again and again and again. So I remember the one long conversation, longish conversation I had with Barack Obama when I was the finance minister of Greece. The first thing he said to me was, I feel solidarity for the Greek people and we are behind you, but there's not much I can do to help. Okay? And then he immediately, without me saying anything, he went into a soliloquy justifying himself by saying, you know, when I got elected, I realized there was nothing I could do because Wall Street had just imploded and I had to save them. And that was, he said, political poison for me. Now, I don't know whether he believed it or not. And I can't see how he can explain the fact that he appointed Larry Summers to sort out the mess. Unless, of course, you know, you adopt the cynical view that it takes a murderer to work out how the criminal justice system should be reformed. This is effectively the point I'm making. So, is capitalism consistent or sustainable within a democratic polity? Can it coexist with democracy? Absolutely not. Because capitalism is generating this shift of power away from the political sphere. And even if you have fantastically scripted constitutions, beautiful congresses with wonderful procedures and so on, power is going to shift away from those processes. They're going to become fig leaves for a system where power lives somewhere else. In my first meeting of finance ministers in Europe, I was exposed to this harsh reality, which I always knew, but it's one thing to know it as a radical lefty that theorizes, quite another to be told straight in your face. That was the beauty of those few months I spent in government, was exactly that. I didn't have to theorize anymore. I went to my first meeting of the Eurogroup. The Eurogroup is the meeting of the European Union finance ministers of the countries that share the same currency, the euro. So I walked in there and I tried to be as moderate as anyone who comes from a country that is bankrupt and whose new government has a title, or the party that won, Coalition of the Radical Left. Yeah? So there I was, the Minister of Finance representing the Coalition of the Radical Left in that cesspool of conservatism. All I said was, we are facing a challenge, colleagues, I said. There is the principle, I said, of continuity in liberal democracies. In other words, we're not going to start at year zero just because we were just elected. We have obligations to you that previous governments, Greek governments, have assumed, and which, of course, we were against, our party was against, but nevertheless, our state, because of the principle of continuity, still has these obligations to you, and therefore I cannot dismiss them. At the same time, there is another principle, the principle of democracy. I could see that they didn't like that very much. And the principle of democracy is very simple. I have a mandate from the people of Greece to challenge all these obligations that we have, this particular fiscal and monetary policy that you've been imposing upon my country, which led to a Great Depression, which led me to be here, because if we didn't have a Great Depression, the Greeks were not stupid enough to vote for me. You know, our party went from 4% to 40% in 2.5 years because of the Great Depression. And I said, well, what happens in a democracy when two principles clash, the principle of continuity and the principle of democracy? Well, we sit around the table like civilized people and we find a compromise. This is what democracies do, liberal democracies, yes? I sit down, the French minister loved what I said, of course, you know. Just complete hot air. Yes, 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 yes. I could see Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, he was looking at me, and he gets the floor, and he said, one sentence. Elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. My response was, this is excellent news to the Chinese Communist Party, because they believe that too. And I then came up with a proposal. This is why they hated me. I was a bit very moderate. I said, in that case, Wolfgang, let's ban elections in bankrupt countries. Let's come out and declare that in the European Union, you can only have democracy if you're a creditor country. And also the proposal that we suspend elections while a country is in the red in the European Union. That would be more honest. So the reason why I'm mentioning this is that Schäuble was right. In the capitalist, the globalized, financialized capitalism that we have created, elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. We live in pure ironclad oligarchies which require for legitimation purposes and for their reproduction that we think that we live in democracies. Now, the tragedy is that capitalism is being overthrown. Not by the left. We are useless. Progressives, left-wingers, are a catastrophe. Eh? Let's face it, capitalism is overthrowing itself with no help from us. And it's doing it in two ways. Firstly, think of 2008. This financialization process that I described imploded under the weight of its own hubris. And the result is a never-ending crisis. Don't believe anybody who tells you that the 2008 crisis ended. It never ended. It is continuing. It is mutating. It's taking different forms. It migrates. It goes to different parts of the world. It takes, for instance, in Germany, it takes the form of negative interest rates that are eating into the pension funds of the average middle-class person, who then turns against the political system and votes for the fascists of the Alternative for Deutschland. They don't have unemployment, but they have this sense of deflation of their hard-earned savings that creates the rise of xenophobia, racism, and the ultra-right. In my country, we have a Nazi party in parliament because we have a Great Depression, because we have an unemployment rate of 30%. And we have no interest rates because nobody's lending to anyone, because everybody's bankrupt. Yeah? In China, you have an investment rate. The proportion of GDP, of national income, that goes into investment is gigantic. It's 48%. 48 cents to every dollar earned in China goes into investment. Now, investment is a good thing, but overinvestment simply means that the Chinese authorities have given up on the West, because, let's face it, the only reason why you don't have a Great Depression in this country today is because in 2008, which was your version, our version of 1929, two things happened differently to what happened in 1929. One was that the Federal Reserve started printing money as if there's no tomorrow. Didn't happen in 1929. And the second thing was China boosted its investment ratio so high in order to rebalance global capitalism. They did it very well. But it's not sustainable. So Europe is not sustainable. China is not even sustainable. And the United States today, which is celebrating growth, what growth? You have 2.5% growth. All the things that shouldn't grow, grow. The things that should grow are not growing. You do not have any serious investment in good quality jobs in this country. You have wage stagnation. This idiocy of the Democratic Party that Putin won the election against Hillary Clinton. Come on, wake up. You cannot say to Trump voters that they're idiots and Putin duped them. I mean, you can say that, but then that's it. You lose them forever. And it's also not true. People say to me, well, how do you explain that Trump won? I'm an economist, so I look at numbers. The number that I think is most spectacular in this country is that in 2016, more than half of the families in this country could not afford the cheapest new car, which cost $14,000. Either they didn't have the money, or they didn't have the money and they did not have the credit ratings necessary to borrow $14,000. More than half of the families cannot afford the cheapest car. That's why Trump got elected, because Obama failed spectacularly to shift the burdens of the crisis of the financial sector onto the 0.1%. So, let's end on a positive note. Shall we? Technically, it's really very simple how to solve the problem. We need a new deal. Except that this must be an international new deal. Exactly as the New Deal was in 1933, but globally. That's not new. Bretton Woods was an international New Deal. So we need a new Bretton Woods. We need progressives in this country, progressives in Europe, to get their act together and start collaborating and start believing that it is possible to do that which has already been done before. It's not pie-in-the-sky stuff. Now, this in order to ameliorate the effects of the ongoing crisis after 2008. Then, once we stabilize the world, like Bretton Woods stabilized the world after the Second World War, then we can start thinking about post-capitalism. Because we must. Capitalism is overturning itself, not only through its crisis, but also through the technologies that it is creating. 3D printing, artificial intelligence, the internet will make sure that in a few years there will be no need to have a corporation. Corporations will lack their raison d'etre. The only reason why you have General Motors is economies of scale. Economies of scale are dying because of the new technologies that capitalism is creating. You are going to have a situation in which we are going to have magnificent productivity, magnificent capacity to produce stuff, but the large majority will not be able to buy any of it. So that will be a crisis of not just the poor and the have-nots, but also the haves. But we must never believe that because there is going to be a crisis of capitalism, because capitalism is going to undermine and overthrow itself, good things will happen. In the 1930s, capitalism imploded and Nazism happened. So we can have one certainty: capitalism cannot maintain itself. Something else, another system of organizing economic and political life is going to follow. And we better make sure that the way in which we choose as a species, as a humanity, that different way of doing things is selected democratically. Because even though democracy takes too long, as Oscar Wilde said, socialism would never happen because it takes too many long evenings. And it's tedious. There's no doubt about that. If you've been to a political meeting, you know how tedious it is. It's the only choice we have. And thankfully, we are creating the technologies that will make these debates both more manageable and more hopeful in terms of delivering a future that resembles, as I say in the book, Star Trek and not The Matrix. Thank you.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, professor of economics and former Greek finance minister. You heard an excerpt from his Cambridge Forum talk, How Capitalism Fails. Is Capitalism Devouring Democracy? You can find the full talk on YouTube. Varoufakis had been invited to the U.S. to talk about his most recent book, Talking to My Daughter About the Economy. Among his other books are Adults in the Room and The Weak Suffer What They Must and The Global Minotaur, America, the True Causes of the Financial Crisis and the Future of the World Economy. Yanis Varoufakis is a co-founder of an international grassroots Democracy in Europe movement 2025. After teaching for many years in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, he's currently professor of economics at the University of Athens. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.